Welcome to Global Minnesota Podcasts, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesotans with the world and exploring important international issues. For a complete list of programs and to join us, visit globalminnesota.org.
I chose a somewhat cheesy title for this talk, but that's only because I'm a big admirer of Clint Eastwood and Eli Wallach and everything else. And so if any of you feel like humming the music from Fistful of Dollars, please do so. Yes, sure, I will. We've decided not, I have a sufficiently loud voice, too loud is what my students tell me, so that should not be a problem. I will. So I'm going to talk about a bunch of things today. But let me start at a somewhat unusual place. I'm going to go somewhat back in history. This is a figure which, for selected countries in Europe, shows the proportion of the population that was engaged in agriculture. Going back to the 14th century, this is for England, Netherlands, Italy, France, and Poland. What do I want you to get out of this picture? What I want you to get out of this picture is that for most of these countries, for roughly 500 years, and even greater if you go further back, the vast bulk of the population, in this case, over half the population for the typical country in this group, was engaged in agriculture. That is, these were people who were growing their own food to feed primarily their own families, were sewing their own clothes, were, in fact, cutting down trees to build their own shelter. That was what the world was like, even for the United States, more recently, since independence, when roughly 80% of the population was engaged in agriculture, even in the middle of the 19th century, over half the population was engaged in agriculture. We're down now to 2%. When I look at these figures, what I get out of this is what a massive waste of human potential. How many Picassos were drawing weird figures in their head while they were behind the plow of their horse-drawn plow. How many Maria Callas's sang while they were sewing, and nobody except their immediate family heard them. The essential point of this kind of development that we've seen, and it's been truly extraordinary, especially over the last two and a half centuries or so, is that we have become increasingly more specialized in the kinds of things we do. I would be a terrible farmer, right? Probably a lot worse than I am as a lecturer in economics, but certainly I'm much happier being able to focus my energies on the kinds of things that I can do well rather than the things I cannot do well. And the history of human development has been this process whereby people have been allowed and have been encouraged and have been induced and have chosen to focus their talents and their energies on activities in which they are the most productive, in which they are the most efficient. And that's all happened. That occurrence is what has led to the dramatic increase in prosperity across the world that we've seen, especially over the last 250 years. So the first essential point is, this is an economic point, that specialization is a very good way, and it's a necessary way, to allow each one of us to live up to our potential so that we can focus on the kinds of things that we are particularly good at rather than the kinds of things that we are not so good at. But specialization cannot occur without exchange, without trade. If I am to focus on doing research in economics, somebody else better focus on on producing the food and the clothing and the shelter and the transportation that I need in order to be successful in my chosen occupation. In turn, they get the benefit, not obvious to some of my students, but they get the benefit of being educated by me, right? And so that's a mutually beneficial exchange, which can happen only if two things happen at the same time, specialization and exchange. Both of those are essential components of human progress. Now, there's always an on the other hand, when an economist speaks, and so, yes, specialization has all these benefits along with trade, but specialization often involves a great deal of commitment of time and energy and resources in order to allow each individual to become skilled at the occupation that they are good at. Once they've invested all that time, all that energy, all of those resources in order to be good at their chosen tasks, then specialization imposes risks because the world changes all the time. The skills that you have may become obsolete. I noticed that the American Association of Woodturners is headquartered in the Landmark Center. You can imagine that the occupation of being a woodturner could be overturned completely if we discover new technologies for building attractive materials out of something else. And what happens to you who have invested so much of your time and your energy in acquiring those kinds of skills? So it has its benefits, but it also imposes special kinds of risks. So if I want you to get two basic messages out of what, and that's going to underlie much of what I'm going to talk about, it's that human development is impossible without each one of us, individuals or households or firms, learning to specialize, learning to devote our energies to the activities that we are good at, each one of us individually is good at, but that investing that time can make individual occupations very risky. How do we think about trade? Essential to our notion of how we think about trade is that trade is based on the notion of comparative advantage, not absolute advantage. So the story I like to tell is that my father was one of the best farmers I've ever run into. But he was, 10, 20, 30 times better as a lawyer than as a farmer. And so even though he was a better farmer than other people in the village in which he grew up, it made sense for those people to specialize in growing the food that he would eat and him to figure out how to file lawsuits against them in order for him to advance the legal profession. And so it made sense for him to specialize in law, and somebody else who was in an absolute sense less productive than he to specialize in farming, because those people were better farmers than they were lawyers. If you want to be mathematical about it, what matters in determining the patterns of trade is the ratio, if you will, of your abilities at various tasks, that rather than the absolute level of those kinds of tasks. 2 days ago, I was listening to this an interesting program on Minnesota Public Radio called Indivisible, where they try and have adult conversations like the ones that we're having. And one of the callers seemed like a pretty smart guy, ran a manufacturing firm in New England, had a strong Bostonian accent, always a charm to hear, not so much of a charm to understand. And he said, it's Econ 101. We have lost our comparative advantage. By definition, you cannot lose your comparative advantage. Even if somebody else becomes absolutely better at the tasks that you do, it makes sense for them to specialize in tasks at which they're relatively better, and for you to specialize in tasks at which you are relatively better. Now, let's talk a little bit about what the patterns of trade have been. So this is a graph which shows trade, both exports, imports, and something called the volume of trade, which is just the sum of exports and imports divided by two, as a share of GDP, as a share of the total value of goods and services we provide, produce in the United States. Trade has become dramatically more important since the post-war era. We roughly exported and imported about 4% of our GDP in the 50s. Today, we export and import something of the order of about 14% of our GDP. So trade plays a much more important role in our lives. Specialization has increased. We are good at producing soybeans and airplanes and software. And the rest of the world is good at producing iPhones, in some cases automobiles, even though we're pretty good at producing automobiles too, and a variety of other goods that we consume. That specialization has allowed the United States to prosper and the rest of the world to prosper, because each one of us focuses our energies on the things at which we are relatively good. What we see for the United States is true also for the rest of the world. The rest of the world always used to be much more open than the United States. Most of the countries in the world are not continent-sized nations the way the United States is. They exported and imported something of the order of about 25% of GDP in the 50s, and now it's 60%. There are some countries, like Hong Kong, which import and export 250% of their GDP. It's mainly because they're points of transshipment. Stuff comes into Hong Kong, goes into China, comes back into Hong Kong, and goes out. All right. Let me turn now to some common misconceptions people have about trade. The first misconception is that trade is a zero-sum game. If shoes get produced in Italy, that just means that cobblers in America lose their jobs. This is the whole point of the argument about specialization is this is false. Trade is a positive sum game. It's a positive sum game almost by definition, as long as it's voluntary. If it's voluntary, people are choosing to sell some of their stuff abroad. They're choosing to buy some of their stuff from abroad. It is something that benefits the parties involved directly, and one can argue that in most situations, it benefits nations and other parties who are not directly involved in that trade as well. The second popular misconception is that something called trade deficits. Now, trade deficit is simply a measure of how much your imports exceed your exports. There's a popular misconception that we should always have balanced trade. This is also profoundly misconceived. And the basic reason why it's misconceived is that if I trade you a bushel of soybeans for an iPhone today, we call that static trade. The trade is balanced. Suppose instead I choose to sell you a bushel of soybeans today in exchange for iPhones tomorrow. That'd be a situation where today I'm running a trade deficit, tomorrow I will be running a trade surplus, today I'm running a trade surplus, tomorrow I'll be running a trade deficit. What difference does it make whether this transaction happens across time or at a point in time? In our jargon, there's no real distinction between what we call intertemporal trade, that occurs across time, and static trade, or trade that occurs at a point in time. Right? They're both neutral. Now, trade deficits may be a symptom of other kinds of deeper problems, but we should never mistake the symptom for the ailment. The ailment may be that we're running budget deficits that are too large, or that our tax policies are very badly set up. It could be a variety of different ailments, but the symptom itself is not something that needs directly to be addressed. It may be used as a diagnosis of the underlying ailment, but not as a stopping the ailment does not stop the disease. This is something all of us know. There's a final point, which will, if people want to talk about it, I'll talk about it. I put this up only because one of the main advisors to the president now says stupid things like this. I'm pleased to say that that person does not have a PhD from the University of Minnesota. I would be forced to put myself in sackcloth and ashes. If he were, he did graduate from a prestigious East Coast institution, and so that should tell you how much you should regard those kinds of institutions. This is a graph of the historical pattern of trade deficits for the United States. In the 50s and the 60s through the 70s, our trade was roughly balanced. What has happened more recently, especially since the mid-90s, is that our trade deficit has ballooned. It's now about 6% of GDP. Why has it ballooned? An important reason why it has ballooned is, in some sense, exact opposite of what you might think. It turns out that many countries in the world, China, to some extent even the European Union and Japan, for a variety of reasons, have chosen, individually and collectively, to save a lot for the future. One way you save a lot is by acquiring assets abroad. The United States has been a favored destination for many of these countries. Now, what does it mean to say I acquire an asset abroad? What that means literally is I walk up to somebody and who owns, let's say, Rockefeller Center or Columbia Pictures. I give them some money. In exchange for that, they give me title. But what's the real transaction that has happened? In order for that to happen, I must have shipped today a whole bunch of goods to the US in exchange for receiving these titles. Because what are the titles? At the end of the day, those are promises that the US has made to deliver goods and services in the future. So it's an example of intertemporal trade. So primary driver has been that the rest of the world has, relative to the US certainly, has chosen to accumulate a lot of foreign assets. In fact, you see that here. This plot gives you the proportion of our net foreign asset position. That's essentially the assets we hold abroad less assets that foreigners hold in the US, and that's now roughly of the order of about 3% of GDP. Trade has other advantages also. Those of us who lived through the big explosion of Japanese cars in the United States in the 70s and the 80s following the oil price increases know this vividly. Suddenly we had smaller, more efficient, and along a bunch of dimensions, better designed cars from Japan, which helped promote competition and helped discipline our large domestic automobile producers. An important, increasingly important aspect of trade is that trade consists of supply chains. Best way I can illustrate this is, what's the largest category of exports that the United States makes to Canada? Well, it turns out to be automobiles and automobile parts. What's the largest category of imports from Canada? Automobiles and automobile parts. Same sort of thing is true with Mexico. So what's going on? Well, what's going on is that the big automobile producers have lots of plants in Ontario and lots of plants in Detroit. They find it efficient to make parts in the US, ship it abroad, those parts get assembled to partially finished cars, comes back to get finished cars, which then go back to Canada or go back to Mexico. The same sort of thing is going on. For a variety of reasons, it turns out it's efficient for the big automobile producers to try and focus their production at each plant on a relatively limited number of parts and do the final assembly somewhere else. And then the process of putting the parts together used to happen when Henry Ford built the River Rouge plant. That plant was supposed to employ 60,000 people, and the basic vision was you'd get iron ore at one end and rubber sand, and out would come out a car. Now, instead of having everything in one giant plant, What we choose to do is to have lots of smaller plants at lots of different locations and ship the stuff not within the plant but across the plants because of various differences in labor productivity at various specific kinds of tasks. It's dangerous for an economist to get into this area, but I do want to emphasize that there's clear evidence that increased trade and increased engagement reduces the likelihood of international conflicts, and I'll come back to that in a minute. So how about the politics of trade? The politics of trade are actually pretty straightforward. Within any trading system, to some extent, each country has an incentive to try and exploit whatever monopoly power it has. The United States is trying to exploit its monopoly power, intellectual property products, in order to raise the price of those kinds of things. And so therefore, there's an incentive collectively on the part of the United States to interfere in those kinds of arrangements. The problem, of course, is every other country has the same incentive to try and do the same sort of thing. And you can get into a self-destructive cycle where we are all collectively worse off by pursuing our own narrow, immediate self-interest. There's also a second argument, which I'll skip over for a minute. The main political problem with trade is that trade confers diffuse benefits. It benefits the vast majority of consumers and vast majority of workers, but it imposes concentrated costs, precisely because of specialization. Classic example, which we talked about yesterday, which shows up all the time, is what are the kinds of products on which the United States imposes tariffs, not products where we have any kind of monopoly power? It's something like sugar. Where does the pressure to impose quotas on sugar come from? It comes from, yesterday I said two specific places because I wanted to skip over Minnesota and North Dakota. But really, in all honesty, it comes from Florida, and it comes from the Red River Valley. If you're a congressman representing the Red River Valley, where, of course, sugar beets are a popular crop, you want to try and make sure that the price of sugar stays high domestically. So you lobby very hard to try and do this. Now, each one of us, I like sugar, but I have one spoon of sugar a day. I mean, it's just not that important for me to call my congressman and say, no, you got to get those tariffs down. But if you're a farmer in the Red River Valley, this is a big deal for you. And so therefore, you have a strong incentive to try and lobby. So how do countries overcome this kind of problem? A good example is what I call the liberal international order, which in many ways was set up after World War II. The first half of the 20th century is a very sad century in the history of human history. Right? We went through two major wars. We went through the creation of an evil system which killed maybe 20, 25 million people in the Soviet Union, maybe 100 million people in communist China. All this is a legacy of the latter part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century when countries believed that the way that they would get ahead was, in fact, to be strongly nationalist, pursue their own interests at the expense of other countries' interests. The mindset was trade is a zero-sum game. So if England benefits, Germany must lose. If that's your mindset, then you want to have colonies, then you want to go out and invade and take over countries with natural resources, and what do you end up with? 200 million people dead. That was the price that we paid. And enlightened leaders all across the industrial world at the end of World War II, in essence, swore never again. We're not going to go through these horrors ever again. And how do we prevent ourselves from going through these horrors? We build stronger ties among each other. And an important component of those stronger ties is trade. And so they set up something that was called initially the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs. Now it's called the World Trade Organization. They set up the UN, they set up the World Bank, they set up the IMF, essentially to promote peaceful trade and peaceful cooperation amongst all of these people. By one measure, This has been a dramatic success. The last 60 years represents a period of time when none of the major industrial powers went to war with each other. We tend to take that for granted, but we have to remember the history of the first half of the 20th century is you can't take that for granted. And when major industrial powers, imagine the United States and Germany or the US and the UK or the US and Japan, engaging in a major conflict, the kind of technology, the kind of materials, the kind of manpower, the kind of resources that these countries can bring to that kind of endeavor, even setting aside nuclear missiles, can cause incredible devastation. In contrast, the notion that that some countries get involved in a conflict in Sudan or even in Iraq, that kind of, even if it's horrible, it confers much less human damage. So it's critically important that the major industrial powers at least stay at peace with each other. And that's something that this liberal international order set up. I'll go back to this program, Indivisible, that I heard, and the theme of that part of the program, which I found very interesting, was that one of the president's principal advisors, Steve Bannon, proclaimed at some conference that he saw the conflict no longer as between parties, historically defined, but rather between nationalists and globalists. And he viewed himself as a nationalist, that is somebody primarily concerned with the interests of the citizens of the United States of America, rather than being somebody concerned about the whole world. It's about as misbegotten an idea as it gets, because Franklin Roosevelt, Truman, Churchill, Anurin Bevin, Charles de Gaulle, these were all people who were deeply committed to the citizens of their own countries. They were nationalists in the best sense of the term. They were patriots. But being patriots, they understood that in order to create a stable international order, you had to create a spirit of cooperation, you had to create a spirit of trade, you had to create a spirit of exchange. And it was precisely because they were nationalists that they entered into these kinds of international arrangements. The consequences of being an unenlightened nationalist is that 100 million people die. The consequence of being an enlightened nationalist is that nations progress and move forward in peace. So let me turn now to a question which has been, I think, on the minds of lots of people. There is across not just this nation, this is true for the UK, we saw that with the Brexit vote. This is true for Poland, where a strongly nationalist government is in power. This is true in Hungary, with a strongly nationalist government. It's true in France, where Ms. Le Pen is gaining a lot of support. It's true across the entire industrialized, developed world, that a very substantial mass of the population is convinced that things have gone grievously, seriously wrong. And they have come together, in effect, to challenge this liberal international order that we set up in the wake of World War II, saying that that order no longer satisfies our needs and our aspirations. So we need to replace it. So I want to ask myself, why are so many people deeply dissatisfied with the current state of affairs? And I'll offer a partial diagnosis of that. So here is the way I'm going to offer that diagnosis is that here's a plot on a proportionate or a log scale. For those of you who are technical, it just means that this is roughly twice as big as that, that's about four times as big, and so on and so forth. What that means is that if I draw a straight line, this is a plot of GDP, value of goods and services, per person in the United States, going back to 1947. So what it means if I draw a straight line through it, That means that the growth rate, the rate at which the stuff is growing, is roughly constant. This is a plot of the same sort of picture, except I've scaled it by the population between the ages of 16 and 64. What do I want you to get out of this figure? Two things. One is that if you stop at roughly about 2007, that's the point over there, what you see is that sometimes the economy was below the red line. Think of the red line as like a trend or average growth rate line. Sometimes it was above it, but anytime that it was below it, it came back pretty quickly back to the trend line. Anytime it was above it, it tended to come back to the trend line. I want to draw in particular attention to the recession of the early 1980s, late 70s and early 1980s, when President Carter and President Reagan were in office. And what you see, until then, that was the steepest decline, until recently, that was the steepest decline since the Great Depression. And what I want you to get out of this is look how quickly the economy recovered back to get to that trend line. For those of you who, many of you I think are in that group, if you remember Morning in America, this is Morning in America. What the president, that was Ronald Reagan's slogan in his re-election bid, and there was a sense in which you could see there was morning in America because the economy was growing very rapidly back up to the trend line. You can hardly see the recessions of the early 90s on this figure or the recession following the NASDAQ boom, the tech boom of the early 2000s. But then you come to, so that's the first point, that the economy has fluctuated around that trend line, but has tended to come back to it. Move forward to 2008, and what we saw was a major financial crisis, which we are all familiar with, when GDP declined very dramatically in 2008 and 2009. But what I want you to do is to follow this blue line for the 8 years since then. And what does this blue line show? It shows no sign of coming back to the red line. All right? It's persistently below. This is something which, in modern experience, for the United States, is unprecedented. We have never seen an 8-year period when we have been significantly below our trend rate of growth. How large is that? Well, the answer is that we're roughly 11% below trend. 11% is a big number. The typical American family makes, in the course of a year, roughly something on the order of about $60,000. What you've told them is that they're going to be poorer by the look of it for a long time. They're going to be 10%, 11% poorer than they used to be, $6,000, $7,000 poorer forever. And once you set aside food and gas and paying the mortgage bill, what you're left with is very bleak times. So think about a typical American household in 2008. They had made plans based upon, some of them knew that their incomes were going to, knew that in all likelihoods their incomes were going to go down. Some of them thought they were going to go up. There's a diversity, as there should be. But when you average across all of these people, what you find is that on average, they're about 11% poorer than they thought they were going to be, and they see no signs that that's going to ever come back. So I would argue that this simple observation, which has been under-recognized and which holds true for Europe, it holds true for Latin America, it holds true for a huge fraction of the industrial developed world. This disappointment at the possibilities and the potentials that they saw and that they made their plans on have not been realized. Now, part of this decline is because of many people in this room. I'm going to exclude myself. I'm only 30 years old, as you can tell. But it's because of demographics. The baby boom has been aging. And the natural thing that happens is that as people reach their 60s, increasingly it's getting delayed, but as people reach their 60s and their 70s and so on, they decide there are more valuable things to do with their time than to work. And so the aging of the baby boom itself is going to introduce a natural reduction in the size of the population that is willing and able to work. And I've done some calculations which indicate that the effects of the baby boom itself account for roughly half the labor shortfall. That is, employment now, total number of people working is slightly above where it was in 2007, but it would have been significantly below the trend line even if we had not had a financial crisis, just simply because the mechanical fact that people are, you've got this pig in a python is the way people describe it, got this baby boom generation, which created a lot of ruckus when they were young. I was part of that ruckus. And are going to create even more storms as they move on. Just thinking about the amount of health care that they're going to need. No, with that generation, need is not relevant. Thinking about the amount of health care that they're going to demand and insist that they get, right? Hard to find a more self-regarding generation than the baby boomers. All right. Lots of people talk about manufacturing. I'm going to start. Where am I? Yeah. Lots of people talk about decline of manufacturing as somehow central to the widespread discontent. I think there's some merit in it, but it's really oversold. And one way of understanding the sense in which it is oversold is that as a share of the total number of people working in the United States, manufacturing in the 50s and through the 60s was about 20-25% of the total workforce was engaged in manufacturing. The decline in manufacturing long predates China's entry into the WTO, all the other upheavals, and so on and so forth. It's pretty much steadily declined pretty much every year since the 1960s, so that now roughly about 8% of the workforce is engaged in manufacturing. All right. Why? The culprit, if there's a culprit, and there's no real culprit as I'll argue, what has happened is that is the same sort of thing that happened in the 19th century to agriculture. Lots of us used to be engaged in the process of growing food. We got better at making food. So that liberated, if you will, a whole bunch of us to pursue other occupations. Technological progress in agriculture, better varieties, increased use of farm equipment, all of that allowed people to move away from the drudgery of farm work into the liberating mindlessness of sitting in little cubicles. So that's what happened. Now, what you're seeing is we have become much more productive at, and the world as overall, has become much more productive at producing the kinds of goods that you see from manufacturing, whether it's refrigerators or automobiles or anything else, mainly as a consequence of automation, robotics, stuff like that. None of that is recent. The first numerically controlled machines were introduced in the 1950s. These are what we now call robots. Right? This technology is not at some deep level anything new. And that has caused a big erosion. And you can see that if you look at the rate of what we call productivity growth in manufacturing, it's dramatically higher than the rate of productivity growth in the economy as a whole. How has that manifested itself? The way that's manifested itself is that manufactured goods, relative to other goods, think education, healthcare, as two leading examples, have gotten a lot cheaper. All right? If you compare the price of an automobile compared to the price of a year in college, that relative price has changed very dramatically. All right? My children went, for whatever reason, to fairly expensive colleges, so I described it as paying their tuition every year was like driving a BMW to an edge of a cliff and just pushing it over. That was not the case at one time. We'll talk about how much we can blame for education. The result of all this is that while manufacturing, you take the dollar value of all manufactured goods divided by the dollar value of all goods and services produced in the U.S., that's manufacturing value added relative to manufacturing GDP, from a peak of about 25%, it's now down to about 12%. But actually, if you use a slightly different measure, which is you say, okay, let me just count up weight in appropriate ways, the amount of refrigerators and automobiles and other manufactured goods that we produce about as much of those kinds of goods relative to GDP as we ever used to. It's just that they've gotten a lot cheaper. And they've gotten a lot cheaper because we've shifted away from the use of labor in producing these kinds of goods, and we're employing far fewer people. So it's fantasy to imagine that we're going to be able to roll back 50 years of, I won't call this progress, I'll call it, be more neutral, 50 years of this kind of change and restore ourselves to some magic days when a huge fraction of our workforce worked at Westinghouse and Alice Chalmers and General Electric. It's just not gonna happen. All right. Okay, let me wrap up. I'll just skip over this because I do want to allow some time for some questions. Where do we go from here? I'd argue there are, the central thing is, as I mentioned early on, specialization is risky. When you are a pipe fitter and you're 55 years old and you lost your pipe fitting job, it's awfully hard to tell that person, hey, go become a software engineer, right? So we need to find ways of protecting people from the risks associated with that, mainly to induce them to take on those kinds of specialized kinds of tasks. We need to find better retraining programs for people in their 20s and their 30s when certain occupations go out because of trade or because of technology or for whatever reason. We do have to find some way of addressing international migration. It's very clear from our own history and from the history of other nations, the willingness of people to tolerate a large number of immigrants from other countries is there. It was always the largest in the United States, but it's somewhat limited. The peak of the foreign-born population was in the early part of the 20th century. In a couple of years, we will exceed that. This is roughly around slightly over 14% of our population was foreign-born. In 1925, we closed the doors in the United States. In 1965, we opened the doors again, and this is part of a cycle. We need to find ways of addressing genuine concerns people have about acculturating new generations to become Americans. We do need to find ways of strengthening international organizations. And finally, this is part of the reason I'm here, we need to educate the populace at large about the benefits of trade, because these benefits are large, these benefits are real, and in my view, stepping outside my shoes as an economist, a really important source of these benefits is that it reduces the likelihood of international conflicts, and so therefore it leads to the prospect of the world that all of us dream of, which is a world that's governed by mutual respect and peace. Thank you.